Joe is a kind of old-fashioned cold warrior and a bit of a silly ass, too. But once you're in the job, you won't have to see much of him. And, he added, since when I'm in America, I'm usually based less than half an hour's drive from his part of the world. You probably will be seeing a lot more of me, if you can stand that. He winked at Myra, and then reported that he was late for another of those damn meetings way on the other side of town, and he hoped they'd all see one another one day soon in Pasadena, and was gone. Ranjit and Myra looked at each other. "Where's Pasadena?" he asked. "In California, I'm pretty sure," she said. "Do you suppose that's where you'd be based? If you took this job, I mean?" He gave her an exasperated grin. "You know what? Maybe we should ask Gamini's father about all this." Which they did, or at least left a query at his office. They didn't get an answer right away, though. They didn't get an answer at all until they had made the short hop from New York, LaGuardia, to Washington National, Reagan, and were already welcomed by the people from the AAAS and booked into their new hotel in sight of the Capitol and walking distance from the mall. And all Dr. Bandara's communication said was, "Gamini assures me this person he wants you to see can be of great help to you." But it didn't say great help in doing what, or why Gamini cared in the first place, and so Ranjit sighed and gave up. Which actually was not a great disappointment, because Washington turned out to be full of things that interested him more than some unspecified job to be offered by some still unmet person named Orion Bledsoe. The first thing, with Ranjit and Myra escorted there by enthusiastic volunteers from the AAAS, was the famous, which actually Ranjit had never heard of before coming to Washington, cluster of museums collectively known as the Smithsonian Institution. London's British Museum and New York's American Museum of Natural History had delighted him. This Smithsonian, not just one fabulous structure, but a whole row of the things, staggered his imagination. All he could make time for was the Air and Space Museum and a quick peek into one or two of the others, but the space collection had, among countless other things, an actual working model, though not to scale, of the Artsutanov space elevator, which was even now beginning to be spun out in the skies above Sri Lanka. And then he had his own keynote speech to give the AAAS convention, and, that having been done and once again declared a triumph, he had their whole damn convention to pick and choose among. Bear in mind that this celebrated genius, among Earth's most honored scientific minds, world-famous and already possessed of 3 actual doctoral degrees given by 3 of the world's most prestigious schools, although in fact he had never quite achieved even a bachelor's degree for himself, this modern Fermat or even Newton had never, in his not very long life, been lucky enough to sit in on a single scientific convention of any kind, except ones for which he was the principal speaker. He had no idea so much could be learned on so many subjects. His own chores attended to, he had the freedom of the convention, and he used it, attending sessions on cosmology and Martian and Venusian and European tectonics and something called machine intelligence, awareness of self. That primarily for Myra, but it fascinated Ranjit almost as much when he listened. And heaven only knew what arcane aspects of what previously unexplored by Ranjit, other areas of human investigation turned up somewhere on the vast and challenging menu of events. Myra kept right up with him, too, as fascinated by the panoply of human learning as he, with a few exceptions. The principal exception was the daily nap after lunch that he insisted on because one of their doctors had insisted. "You're getting ready to have a baby, you know," he informed her every day, although in fact she was never in any doubt of it. And then, on almost the last day of the convention, when Ranjit was tucking her in, they heard a gentle beep-beep from their telephone. It was a fresh text message, and what it said was, "I would be grateful if you could join me in my suite sometime today to discuss a proposal that I think will interest you. T.O. Bledsoe, Lieutenant Colonel USMC, retired." Ranjit and Myra looked at each other. "It's the man Gamini was talking about in New York," Ranjit said, and Myra nodded briskly. "Of course it is. Go ahead, call him, see what he wants. and then come back here and tell me all about it." The suite belonging to Lieutenant Colonel Retired T. Orion Bledsoe was noticeably bigger than the one the AAAS convention had provided for Ranjit and Myra. Even the bowl of fruit on the conference table in the drawing room was larger, and it wasn't alone on the table either. Next to it was an unopened bottle of Jack Daniel's whiskey with the ice, glasses, and mixers to go with it. T. Orion Bledsoe himself was not much taller than Ranjit, which for an American was hardly tall at all, and at least a couple of decades older. But he still had all his hair and a pretty muscular handshake, though it was the left hand he offered and used to pull Ranjit in.
Come in, Mr. Have a seat. Are you enjoying our district of confusion?"
He didn't wait for an answer either, but led the way to the conference table.
"Care for a drink, Mr. Jack isn't going to be too strong for you?"
Ranjit repressed a smile. Anyone who had spent his wild 16th year ingesting arak was not likely to find some American tipple too strong.
"That would be fine," he said. "Your message said something about a proposal?"
Bledsoe gave him a reproachful look.
"They say we Americans are always in a hurry, but in my experience it's you foreigners that are always jumping the gun. Sure, I want to talk about something with you, but I like to get to know a man a little bit before we do business."
And all the time his previously neglected right hand was gripping the whiskey bottle while the other was opening the seal. Bledsoe noticed where Ranjit's eyes were focused and gave a little chuckle.
"Prosthetic," he admitted, or boasted. "Pretty good design, too. I could even shake hands with it if I wanted to, but I don't. I can't feel your hand if I do, so what's the point? And if I got absent-minded and squeezed a little too hard, you could suddenly be in the market for one of your own."
The artificial arm was actually quite efficient, Ranjit observed, reminding himself to tell Myra about it. The bottle open, the hand was pouring an even 2 centimeters of whiskey into each glass and then passing Ranjit's over to him. Bledsoe watched attentively to see if Ranjit was going to use any of the mixers. When he didn't, Bledsoe gave a little nod of approval and took a taste from his own glass.
"This is what we call sippin' whiskey," he said. "You can chug it down if you want to. Hey, it's a free country. But you ought to give it a chance. Ever been in Iraq?"
Ranjit, sipping a little of the sippin' whiskey out of politeness to his host, shook his head.
"It's where I got this," he tapped the imitation arm with his good one. "With all the Shiites and the Sunnis doing their best to kill each other, but taking time out to kill as many of us as they could along the way. It was the wrong war in the wrong place for the wrong reasons."
Ranjit tried his best to sound interested enough to be polite, wondering whether Bledsoe was going to say the right war would have been Afghanistan or maybe Iran. It wasn't, though.
"North Korea," Bledsoe proclaimed. "They're the ones we should have pulverized. 10 missiles in the 10 right places and they'd have been right out of the game."
Ranjit coughed.
"As I understand it," he said, swallowing a little more of his Jack Daniels, "the trouble with fighting North Korea is that they have a very large and very modern army, and they've got it sitting right on the border, less than 50 kilometers from Seoul."
Bledsoe waved a dismissive hand.
"Hell, sure there'd be losses. A lot of 'em, no doubt. So what? It'd be South Korean losses, not Americans."
"Well," he corrected himself, grimacing at the annoyance,
"all right, there are quite a few American troops right up there, sure. But you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, can you?"
It seemed to Ranjit that the party was getting unpleasant. And then as Bledsoe tossed a crumpled napkin into a wastebasket, he thought he saw a reason. The napkin bounced off an empty whiskey bottle. Apparently his was not the first conference Bledsoe had convened that day. Ranjit cleared his throat.
"Well, Mr. Bledsoe, I come from a small country with problems of its own. I don't want to criticize American policy."
Bledsoe bobbed his head in agreement.
"And that's another thing," he said,
and interrupted himself to offer a refill with the bottle. Ranjit shook his head. Bledsoe shrugged and recharged his own glass.
"Your little island," he said, "Sri Sri Lanka, Ranjit politely corrected. That's the one. Do you know what you've got there?
Ranjit considered.
Well, I think it's probably the most beautiful island in the...
I'm not talking about the whole damn island, for Christ's sake. My God, there's a million beautiful islands around all over the world, and I wouldn't give you a nickel for any of them. I'm just talking about one little harbor you've got there. Trincomalee.
Ranjit took pity.
I think you mean Trincomalee. I was born there.
Really?
Bledsoe considered that datum, found no use for it, and continued.
Anyway, I don't give a damn about the town. It's the harbor that's a world-beater. Do you know what that could be? It could be the world's best base for a nuclear submarine navy, Mr.
He had refilled his glass once again, and the sippin' whiskey was beginning to show its effects. Ranjit sighed and rescued him again.
It's Subramanian, Mr. Bledsoe, and yes, we know what a base it could be. In World War II it was headquarters for the Allied fleet, and before that Lord Nelson himself said it was one of the world's greatest harbors.
Oh, crap, what does Lord Nelson have to do with it? He was talking about a place for sailing ships, for God's sake. I'm talking nukes. That harbor's deep enough that submarines can dive well below what any enemy could find, much less attack. Dozens of them. Maybe hundreds. And what did we do about it? We let goddamn India snap up treaty rights for the whole damn port. India, for God's sake. And what the hell India needs a navy for in the first place? I can't...
Ranjit was getting tired of this opinionated drunk. Gamini was Gamini, but Ranjit couldn't be expected to put up with much more of this. He stood up.
Thanks for the drink, Mr. Bledsoe, but I'm afraid I have to be getting along.
He held out a hand to be shaken in farewell, but Bledsoe didn't reciprocate. He glared up at Ranjit, then deliberately put the top back on the whiskey bottle.
"Excuse me one second," he said. "We have some unfinished business."
He disappeared into one of the suite's bathrooms. Ranjit heard running water, thought it over, shrugged, and sat down. It was more than 1 second, though. It was close to 5 minutes before T. Orion Bledsoe appeared again, and he hardly seemed the same man. His face was scrubbed, his hair was brushed, and he was carrying a partial cup of steaming black coffee, no doubt from the coffee machine that seemed to be standard equipment in any American hotel bathroom. He didn't offer Ranjit any of the coffee. He didn't offer any explanations either, just sat down, glanced at the whiskey bottle as though astonished to find it there, and said briskly,
"Mr. Subramanian, if I should mention the names Whitfield Diffie and Martin Hellman, what would they mean to you?"
Slightly confused by the abrupt change in both subject and demeanor, but a little encouraged by the fact that the conversation had suddenly entered into an area he knew something about, Ranjit said,
"Public key cryptography, of course. The Diffie-Hellman-Merkle procedures?"
"Exactly," Bledsoe said. "I don't think I need to tell you that Diffie-Hellman is in serious trouble because of the quantum computers."
He didn't. Although Ranjit had never taken any particular interest in codes or code-cracking himself, not counting his exploits in learning one professor's computer password, every mathematician in the world had a pretty good idea of what had gone on. Diffie-Hellman was based on a very simple idea, but one that had been so difficult to execute that the idea had been useless until the age of really powerful computers. The first step in encoding any message that one wished to keep private was to represent it as a series of numbers. The simplest way to do that, of course, would be to replace the letter A with a 1, the B with a 2, and so on through Z equals 26. Naturally, no cryptographer in the world, or at least none over the age of 10, would take seriously such a trivial system of substitutions. Then these numbers could be combined with an enormous number, call it N, in such a way that the original simple substitution was concealed. Simply adding the substituted numbers to giant N might do the trick by itself. But N had a secret of its own. The way it was generated by cryptographers was by multiplying two large prime numbers together. Any decent computer could do that kind of multiplication in a fraction of a second, but once the two large primes were multiplied together, trying to discover what the primes themselves had been was a brutal job that even with the best computers could take many years. Hence the description trapdoor cipher, easy to get into, virtually impossible to get out of again. Still, public key cryptography, as it was called, possessed one great virtue. Anybody could encrypt any message from the product of the primes, even, say, some harried member of the French Resistance in World War II, one step ahead of the Gestapo, with some crucial knowledge of where a bunch of panzer divisions were moving to. But only the people who knew what both those primes were could read the message. Bledsoe took a sip of his rapidly cooling coffee.
"The thing is, Subramanian," he said, "we have some pretty important traffic going around the world right now. Don't ask me what it is. I have only a bare glimmering of a notion, and I can't tell you even that much. But at this moment, it is more important than ever that our code be unbreakable. Maybe there's some way of decrypting that doesn't involve all this factoring of prime numbers, hocus-pocus, and if there is, we would like you to help us figure out what it is."
Ranjit tried his best not to laugh. What he was being asked to do was what every code agency in the world had been working on ever since Diffie-Hellman had published their paper way back in 1975.
"Why me?" he asked.
Bledsoe looked pleased with himself.
"When I saw the news stories about your proof of Fermat's last theorem, it rang a bell. All those mathematicians that work on this public key stuff use what they call the Fermat test, right? So who would know more about that than the man who just proved his theorem? And there were others around who liked you, so we started the machinery going to recruit you for our team."
When Ranjit considered all the ways in which Bledsoe's notion was ridiculous, he was tempted to get up and walk away. Fermat's test was certainly the basis for many more recent ways of identifying prime numbers. But to leap from that to the notion that the man who proved Fermat's theorem would be any good at public key code cracking was, well, simply preposterous. All the same, this was exactly the offer that Gamini had asked him to accept. Ranjit controlled the impulse to laugh in Bledsoe's face and said only,
"Recruit me? Does that mean you're offering me a job?"
"Damn straight it does, Subramanian. You'll be provided with all the resources you need, and the U.S. government has plenty of resources and a generous salary. How about—"
Ranjit could not help blinking at the figure mentioned. It would have supported several generations of Subramanians.
"That seems adequate," he commented dryly. "When should I start?"
"Ah, well," Bledsoe said moodily. "Not right away, I'm afraid. It's a matter of your security clearance. You did, after all, spend a couple of months in the slammer back home under suspicion of being associated in terrorist activities."
Then Ranjit did come close to blowing his top.
"That's ridiculous! I wasn't involved in any—"
Bledsoe raised his hand.
"I know. You think I'd be offering you this kind of a job if I didn't know that? But the security clearance people get real antsy when there's a connection with a certified terrorist bunch like your pirates. Don't worry. It's all just about straightened out. We had to go right to the top. It took actual White House intervention, but you'll get your clearance. Only it'll take a bit more time."
Ranjit sighed and bit the bullet.
"How long?"
3 weeks, maybe. At most a month. So what I suggest is you go ahead and do all those speaking dates you've accepted, and when the word comes through, I'll get in touch with you and arrange for your coming to California."
There didn't seem to be much help for it.
"All right," Ranjit said.
"I'll need an address for you so I can keep you posted on where to reach me." Bledsoe grinned. He showed a lot of teeth, a lot of shark-like teeth, when he smiled, Ranjit observed.
"Don't worry," he said. "I'll know where you are."
3 weeks turned into 6, and then into 2 months. Ranjit was beginning to wonder how long the generosity of the foundation that paid their hotel bills would last, and he still had not heard from Bledsoe again. "It's just typical government red tape," Myra said, consoling. "Gamini said to take the job. You took it. Now we just have to live by their timetable."
"But where the hell is Gamini?" Ranjit said sulkily.
He hadn't appeared again, and when Ranjit emailed his father's office to see if they could supply an address, they had simply replied, "He is in the field and can't be reached." At least Myra had the visits to her old friends at MIT to amuse her. Ranjit didn't have that much. When she came back to the hotel, puffing and, yes, you'd have to say it, waddling, but full of news about the great new accomplishments of some of her old buddies, he greeted her with an unexpected question. "What would you think about catching the next plane back to Lanka?" She eased herself and her great belly into a chair. "What's the matter, dear?" "This is going nowhere," he announced, not adding that it was also very cold outside. "I've been thinking about what Dr. Bandara said. Being a full professor at the university wouldn't be a bad life. I'd have a chance to do research, too. And you know there are plenty of other big problems that nobody has solved. If you wanted to be rich, I could see if I could work the bugs out of the Black-Scholes equation. Or if I wanted a real challenge, there's always P equals NP. If anybody could solve that, it would revolutionize mathematics." Myra shifted her weight around in the chair, trying to find a comfortable position. She decided there wasn't one, and leaned over to press her husband's hand. "What's P equals NP? She asked. "Or that other equation?" It was worse than she thought. Ranjit didn't take the bait. "The thing is," he said, "we're just wasting our time here. We might as well give it up and go home." "You promised Gamini," she reminded him. "Just give it a few more days." "A very few," he said stubbornly. "A week at the most, and then we're out of here." It didn't come to that. It was the very next day that the teletext message came from ex-Lieutenant Colonel T. Orion Bledsoe. "Clearance granted. Report to Pasadena ASAP. And they were certainly about ready to get out of Boston's worst-yet climate. But when they were all packed up and just waiting for the limo that was to take them to Logan Airport for the flight to LAX, Myra suddenly put her hand to her belly. "Oh, my," she said. "I think that was a contraction." It was. Once she made Ranjit understand what was happening, it was no problem to divert their limousine from the airport to Massachusetts General Hospital, where, 6 hours later, little Natasha de Souza Subramanian made her first appearance in the world. Chapter 23 Farmer, quote, Bill. And in another part of the galaxy, far, far away. You couldn't say that the Grand Galactics had forgotten about unruly Earth. That never happened. They were constitutionally incapable of forgetting anything. All the same, Earth had certainly slipped into the farther recesses of their collective mind, and their attention was concentrated on more important, or anyway, more interesting issues. In the case of, quote, Bill himself, for example, there was the task of tending to their farm, or perhaps it should be farm in quotation marks, since nothing organic grew there. We wouldn't usually think of the Grand Galactics as farmers of any kind. Nevertheless, there were certain kinds of crops that they encouraged, and it is a curious fact that medieval human peasants had done something very similar with their own tiny plots. The plot that interested Bill enough to cause him to visit it was a volume of space several light-years on a side. At first look, any astronomer might have thought it was nothing but empty space. As a matter of fact, that is exactly what human astronomers had thought when they'd first observed it. It wasn't entirely empty, though. Better observations, achieved when humans had managed to acquire better telescopes, showed that there was something in that patch of space that bent light, refracting blue in one direction, red in the other. That something, as the Grand Galactics had always known, was interstellar dust. This trip was not, of course, Bill's first visit to his farm. Not long before, oh, a matter of a few million years or so before, he had explored it in detail, making a careful census of the dust. What percentage of the dust particles, as humans might measure them, were less than 0.01 micron in size, what percentage, indeed, were in all the size ranges, all the way up to the giants, which were as much as 10 microns across, or even larger. He took note as well of the chemical composition of the dust particles and of their neutron counts and ionization status. All this was a simple and quite easy part of the self-imposed duties of a grand galactic. Bill, however, had always found it among what one could call the most enjoyable duties. After all, his senses would ultimately contribute to one of the great goals the grand galactics possessed. So, like some 11th-century Norman baron, what Bill was doing was riding his fields. The dust patch was what the baron's Saxon serfs would have called a fallow field, allowed to remain unplanted so that the soil could rest and regain its fertility. Bill's patch didn't raise corn or oats. It raised only stars. Big ones, little ones, all kinds. But the Grand Galactics preferred the big ones. Those giants, what humans would call the A's and B's and O's, could be counted on to rapidly burn up their initial stocks of hydrogen in the nuclear furnaces at their cores. Then, when that was gone, they would do the same with their helium, carbon, neon, magnesium, each element heavier than the one that came before, until they came to iron, which was the end of the line. When a star's core has turned to iron, the nuclear furnace at its core weakens until it can no longer fight off the terrible gravitational squeeze of the dead weight of its outer layers. The star collapses on itself, and then it rebounds in a titanic explosion, pouring out new treasuries of heavier elements still, manufactured in the condign heat of that explosion, to turn into tiny particles that will enrich the next patch of interstellar gas. That was what would inevitably happen sooner or later in the normal course of events, and it didn't require any action on the part of Bill. It would be taken care of by those simple Newtonian-Einsteinian laws of gravitation that the Grand Galactics had never seen any reason to change. As we say, sooner or later, but the Grand Galactics preferred sooner. Bill chose to speed things up. He scanned a considerable volume of adjacent space and was lucky enough to find a trickle of nearby dark matter, coaxed it to flow into his patch, and was pleased. One of the Grand Galactic's main objectives was being helped along. And what was that objective? There is no way of expressing it in terms a human being could understand. But one step in its achievement was known to be an increase in the proportion of heavy elements to light. In this case, heavy, meaning those elements with at least 20 or so protons in their nuclei, along with crowds of neutrons. The kind of elements, that is, that the original creation of the universe had omitted entirely. Changing all those light elements to heavy would take much work and vast amounts of time. But time, after all, belonged to the Grand Galactics. Chapter 24. California. The American East Coast might consider itself the center of power, of government, or of culture. Of course, that would depend on which East Coast city you were talking about, New York, Washington, or Boston. But in one very important way, it was definitely inferior to the other edge of the North American continent. Oh, it wasn't the palm trees and the flowers blooming everywhere that thrilled the Subramanians. After all, Myra and Ranjit were Lankans, and a riot of exotic vegetation was their natural ambience. No, the best thing about California was that it was warm. It never got painfully cold, especially around the Los Angeles area, where it wasn't ever really cold at all. So Pasadena, where Ranjit discovered he was based, was a great place to live. Well, it was if you didn't count the possibility of earthquakes, or wildfires that could flatten a whole subdivision of homes in a dry year, or floods that could pull down some other subdivision, one that had been built on precipitous lots because all the flat lots had been built on already, floods that were always ready to do this in a year when some relatively minor fire had killed off enough of the brush to weaken the ground's hold on the substrate. Never mind. Those things might not happen. At least they might not before the Subramanian family had packed up and gone somewhere else. Meanwhile, it was a splendid place to raise a child. Myra happily pushed Natasha's carriage through the local supermarket, along with all the other mothers doing the same, and thought she had never been so lucky in her life. Ranjit, on the other hand, had some doubts. Oh, he loved the good parts of their life in Southern California as much as Myra did, took pleasure in their excursions to the points of interest that were so unlike anything in Sri Lanka, the La Brea tar pits in the heart of the city, where millennia of ancient beasts had been trapped and preserved for humans to wander over well into this 21st century, the movie studios with their brilliantly engineered rides and exhibits. Myra had been a little doubtful about taking Tashi to such a chancy place, but in the event, Natasha chortled and loved it. Griffith Observatory with its seismographs and telescopes and its grand picnic area overlooking the city. What he didn't like was his job. It gave him everything T. Orion Bledsoe had promised, that was true, and even a fair number of things Ranjit hadn't expected at all. He had his own private office, which was spacious, 3 meters by more than 5, if windowless, because like all the rest of this installation it was nearly 20 meters underground, and furnished with a large desk and a large leather armchair for his own use, and several less pricey other chairs at a clear oak table for guests and meetings, and no fewer than 3 separate computer terminals with unlimited access to almost everything. Now all it took was pushing a few keys for Ranjit to get his personal copies of just about every mathematical journal there was in the world. Not only did he get the journals themselves, hard copies when there were hard copies to begin with, electronic copies when that was all the original publishers had produced, he also received translations, horribly expensive but paid for by the agency out of their apparently limitless bank account, of at least the abstracts from those journals that happened to be in languages Ranjit had no hope of ever comprehending. What was wrong was that he had nothing to do. The first few days were busy enough, because Ranjit had to be walked through the places where red tape was generated, so that they could generate Ranjit's own contribution to the supply, identity badge to prepare and documents to sign, all the unavoidable flotsam of any large enterprise in the 21st century. Then, nothing. By the end of the first month, Ranjit, who was never grumpy, was waking up grumpy almost every workday morning. There was a cure. A prescribed dose of Natasha, along with one of Myra, usually cleared the symptoms up before he finished breakfast, but then by the time he came home for dinner he was morose again. Apologetic about it, of course. I don't mean to take it out on Tashi and you, Myra, but I'm just wasting time here. No one will tell me what I'm supposed to be doing. When I find someone to ask, he just gets all mock deferential and says, "Well, that would be up to me, wouldn't it?" But then, by the time he had finished dinner and given Tashi her bath, or changed her diaper, or just dandled her on his knee, who could stay morose? Not Ranjit. And he was then his usual cheery self until the next time he had to get up to go to his non-work. By the end of the second month, the depression was deeper. It took longer to lift because, as Ranjit told his wife over and over, "It's worse than ever. I cornered Bledsoe today, not easy to do because he's hardly ever in his office, and asked him point blank what kind of work I was supposed to be doing. He gave me a dirty look, and do you know what he said? He said, 'If you ever find out, please tell me.' It seems he had orders from high up to hire me, but nobody ever told him what my job was to be. They wanted you because you're famous and you add class to the operation," his wife informed him. "Good guess. I sort of had the same idea myself, but it can't be right. That whole operation's so secret nobody knows who's working in the next office." "So do you want to quit?" Myra asked. "Huh. Well, I don't think so. Don't know if I can, really, because I'm not sure what all I signed. But anyway, I promised Kamini." "Then," she said, "let's just learn to love it. Why don't you solve that P equals NP problem you talk about? And anyway, tomorrow's Saturday, so why don't we take Tashi to the zoo?" The zoo, of course, was a delight, although in the rest of the world things were going as badly as ever. Recent developments? Well, Argentina's vast herds of cattle were keeling over by the thousands with a new variety of the old disease called blue tongue. It had just been confirmed that the plague was a biowarfare strain. What wasn't clear was who had spread it. Maybe Venezuela or Colombia, some people around the agency thought, because Argentina had contributed heavily to the international force that was trying to keep the Venezuelan and the Colombian armies apart. They weren't very successful at it, but the Venezuelans and the Colombians hated them for trying. The rest of the world was as unquiet as ever. In Iraq, nightly outbreaks of car bombings and beheadings showed that the two kinds of Iraqi Muslims were again trying to ensure that there was only one true Islamic faith by exterminating each other. In Africa, the number of officially recognized wars had grown to 14, not counting several dozen tribal skirmishes. In Asia, the adorable leaders, North Koreans, were issuing communique after communique, charging most of the world's other states with spreading lies about them. But in Pasadena, nobody was fighting anybody, and little Tashi Subramanian was delighting her parents. What other infant so precociously tried to turn herself over in her crib at such an early age? Or even more precociously, at that same early age, slept nearly halfway through the night, on many nights sometimes. Natasha Subramanian was bound to be a person of high intelligence, Myra and Ranjit agreed, no matter that Jingting John, the baby doctor the office's advisory service had helped them find, swore that you could tell nothing about a child's intelligence until it was at least 4 or 5 months old. Though weak in that area, Dr. John was a very comforting pediatrician to have, full of tips on the diagnosis of infant crying. Some crying meant that you had to do something right away, some could be ignored until the baby had cried itself out. Dr. John even had recordings of many of the possible crying styles to help them figure which was which. In fact, the advisors had done nearly everything that had to be done for Myra and Ranjit. They had located for them the pretty little apartment in a gated development, 4 rooms, washer-dryer installed, access to the community swimming pool, its own plant-bedecked balcony that looked down on the city of Los Angeles from above, and maybe most important of all in these times, its 24-hour guard service to check every last person going in or out. The advisors had done more than that, too, helping them choose the best dry cleaners, pizza deliverers, banks, and car rental services, until the time when they might choose to buy a couple of cars for themselves, which time had not yet arrived. They had even provided Myra with the names of 3 separate maid services, but Myra chose to decline them all. "The apartment's not that big," she told Ranjit. "What kind of housework is there to do? Vacuuming, cooking, laundry, dishes? Just for the two of us, there's not that much work involved." Ranjit strongly agreed. "I'm sure you can handle it," he said, which got him a slightly frosty look. "I'm sure we can," she corrected him. "Let's see, I'd better be the cook because I'm better at it than you are. So you can clean up afterward? That would be good. Laundry, you can operate a washer and dryer, can't you? They've got all the instructions written out in their manuals, anyway. Changing the baby, feeding the baby. When you're home, we can take turns. When you're not, I can do it myself." Item by item, they ran through the list of domestic jobs, from replacing used light bulbs and toilet paper rolls to paying the bills. It wasn't a problem. Neither one of them wanted the other stuck at some chore that would keep him or her away from the other for a minute longer than necessary, because neither wanted to be so deprived of the other's talk and company. At this point, the armada of 1.5s was cruising at its maximum speed of 0.94C. By the timescale of most non-Earth beings, it would reach its destination in a mere blink of time. Of course, no human being knew this, so all 9 billion went right on with their usual daily concerns. Then, one evening, as the Subramanians were finishing the dinner cleanup, the voice from their intercom spoke up. "Dr. Subramanian, this is Henry down at the gate. There's a man here who'd like to see you. He says he doesn't want to give his name, but you'll know him because he's Maggie's ex-boyfriend. All right to let him in?" Ranjit jumped to his feet. "Gamini," he shouted. "Sure, let the bastard come in and ask him what he'd like to drink." But when the man arrived, he wasn't Gamini Bandara at all. He was a much older man, carrying a locked case that was chained to his right arm. When he opened it, he took out a chip and handed it to Ranjit. "Please play this," he said. "I'm not authorized to see it, so I'll have to wait outside, but Mrs. Subramanian is specifically permitted, and—" He offered them a polite smile. "I'm sure the baby won't tell any secrets." When the courier was safely stowed in the hallway, Myra fed the chip into their player, and a grinning Gamini appeared on the screen.
"Sorry to put you through all this cloak and dagger stuff, but we're walking a tightrope here. We're answering to 5 different national governments plus the UN's own security staff, and, well, I'll tell you all about that another time. The thing is, that other job we've been talking about for you is all cleared now if you want it." "You will. You'd be crazy if you didn't. However, before I answer all those questions, there is one little thing. No, to tell the truth, there's one extremely big thing that has to happen first. I can't say what it is, but you'll know it when you see it on the news, and then you can say goodbye to Pasadena. So stay loose, Ranj. That's all those intelligence agencies will let me say now. Except love to you all."
The chip ended, and the screen went blank. 10 minutes later, when the courier had retrieved his chip and departed, Myra pulled down from the top of the cupboard the bottle of wine they saved for special occasions. She filled 2 glasses, cocked an ear to where Natasha was sleeping, and when satisfied about that said, "Do you know what's going on?" Ranjit clinked her glass and took a sip from his own before he said, "No." He sat silently for a moment and then grinned. "All the same, if I can't trust Gamini, who can I trust? So we'll just have to wait and see." Myra nodded, finished her glass, got up to check on Natasha, and said, "At least it doesn't sound like the waiting will be much longer." It wasn't. It was only 3 days before Ranjit, doing his best to find a few more really large prime numbers for the cryptographers to play with, because his conscience wouldn't let him do nothing at all, heard a huge commotion in the hallway and discovered that half the staff was trying to get into the lounge at the end of the corridor. Everybody was clustered before the news channels. What the channels were displaying was a procession of military vehicles, scores of them, pouring through a gap in an unfamiliar fence. "Korea," a man near the screen called to quiet the questions. "They're going into North Korea. Now shut up so we can hear what they're saying." And North Korea was indeed where they were heading, and none of the adorable leader's huge army seemed interested in trying to stop them. "But that's crazy," the man next to Ranjit was saying. "Something must have happened." He hadn't been looking to Ranjit for an answer, but Ranjit gave him one anyway. "I'm sure something did happen," he told the man, grinning. "Something big."